What's up and welcome to NXpress, the Nintendo show of GoombaStomp.com, also known as the best show of all time, they've been calling it on the street. So welcome to it. We've got another really exciting episode. This episode dedicated almost entirely to Nindies, as there was both a Nindy Direct just yesterday. On top of, we have a very special review of something on the Switch that could be considered an indie game, even though it is truly, truly massive, on top of some other fun discussions of games and reviews. To help me with that, I've got Ricky D.
What's up, Internet? What's up to Mason? What's up, Nintendo Nation?
And I've got Patrick Murphy.
Man, Rick expanded his greeting, and I still don't even have one yet.
I was waiting for it. I was like, I wonder if Patrick's going to come in with a cool greeting.
No, that's like rubbing it in my face, though, Rick.
He's proud of himself. He's over there just smug as can be. Smug as a pug.
By the way, I'm leaving to Cuba tomorrow, but I'm still in a bad mood.
I don't see how that could be possible. You're going to be drunk. Well, I guess because you haven't had any rum yet. Maybe that's the problem.
Well, I'm still looking for a job, so if anyone wants to hire me, wink, wink, Nintendo, I'm currently unemployed. But no, I kind of want to vent, guys. Like, we have a lot of things to talk about, but I kind of want to bring this up because it's come up in conversation several times over the past, I would say, like, week or two. I was actually talking to Simon, one of the co-founders of GoombaStomp.com, about this. And Patrick, you can chime in because, you know, you love movies and you love reviewing movies. But reviewing video games it's not hard, but it is time-consuming. And the reason why I say it's time-consuming is because, look, if you review a movie, so you go to the movie, say you review Deadpool 2. You go to the movie, usually in advance, so like you see a movie like 5 days, a week, 2 weeks before the movie gets released. You sit...
If you're lucky.
Yeah. So you watch the movie. It takes about, what, 2 hours to watch the movie. And then you go home, you think about it, you sit down, you write your review. It could take you maybe an hour and a half, depending on how good and fast of a writer you are. So technically, it's not as time-consuming as, say, reviewing a video game. So say, for example, you want to review Persona 5. So in order to finish that game and finish the actual main campaign with the story mode, you can put in like 90 to 100 hours. And then you have to go review the game. So maybe it'll take you like 2 hours to review the game if you are smart enough to, say, take notes while playing the game. But it still takes you about 90 hours to finish the game. Even a game like Salt and Sanctuary, which I absolutely adore, I put in 65 hours into that game, which is technically an indie game. And 65 hours before I get to the very end, like the final boss, and beat the game, 65 hours. And then I can write my review, which is still going to take me about 2 hours because there's so much to talk about. And so I mention this because what I do not understand, and I'm so frustrated, and it's not everyone. Like, we are kind of lucky because a lot of developers send us review codes in advance, right? Which is great. So, like, we can get a review code of a game 2 weeks prior and play the game and actually enjoy the game and play the game like a normal person would without feeling that stress of having a deadline and finishing the game and having to review up by whatever so date.
You should explain that the reason that there are deadlines, developers, like, actually, they expect coverage for their game and they expect it to come at the release date. They don't, or whenever they lift their embargo. That could be a couple days. So they actually look for that, and if you don't do that, you might get a message from the developer saying, hey, where the hell is the review?
Right, which actually happened today. We had an indie developer that emailed me looking for a review of an indie game, which I was not even aware that we were reviewing. And sure enough, the article was pending. It was just waiting for the writer to sort of, like, go through it and, like, adjust a few things here and there. But the point is, like, what I don't understand is companies know how long these games are. And there are a few companies who I will not mention who will not send the games in advance. There are companies that send us the game the day the game gets released. And I'm like, okay, so thank you very much for giving us a free game, but I didn't contact you for a free game. I don't mind spending the money. I really don't. I actually love supporting games. In fact, I've gone on record and said many times on the podcast that even if, say, for example, I get the review code of Owlboy, I still buying the physical copy of Owlboy 3 months later. Like, I still wanted to actually own the game, right? But the whole point in asking for an advanced copy of the game or review code is so we actually have time to play the game to have that review published the day it gets released. And I don't understand why some of these, it's the PR people, like, they don't get it. Like, I don't know, maybe they just don't play video games. Like, maybe they went to school and wanted to become, like, some kind of, like, PR person and ended up working in the video game industry and don't actually play video games and have no idea how time-consuming it is. It's so incredibly frustrating.
Hey, I majored in PR, so don't you rip on PR people.
It's definitely not up to the PR people. It definitely isn't. But I know exactly what Rick is talking about because I have, like, two sets of experiences that are just polar opposites. One of which, like, I don't mean to overly promote anyone, but my experience with Xbox as the Xbox editor has been sensational. They've been so kind and generous with their codes, and they give them weeks in advance, literal weeks in advance, so that big games like Halo 5 way back in the day, they gave me 2 full weeks to fully beat that game and play it online, which was more than enough time.
Atlas gave me an Etrian Odyssey game 2 months in advance because they knew that this was an RPG and it was going to take a while. So we got it 2 months in advance. That's the right thing to do.
Way back in the day with a JRPG that I was like, this is going to take me forever. And they're like, here's 2 months. And I was like, thanks, that'll do.
And I think, like, the reason that this is important, I mean, you can always argue, like, hey, you guys are getting a free game, what's the problem? But the thing is that if you're rushing through it, this is bad for the developer, because if you have to rush your way through a game, the odds are you're not going to like it quite as much. They need to see, or I'm surprised they can't see, that by forcing somebody to blow through something, there's going to be a little bit more negativity involved because you're under stress, you're under a time crunch, you're just naturally not going to be as disposed positively towards the game as you might have been had you played it like a normal player would. And the point of a review is to communicate to a normal player how this game is going to play. But you can't do that if you're getting a code on the day of release and then are expected to have a review up the next day.
And there is a bigger problem because I see reviews being published by smaller websites, and you can tell that the person did not even finish the damn game.
Yeah,
like, definitely. And there, which company is it? Bethesda? And I think there's one more company where they don't give anyone advanced copies of their games, like not IGN, nobody. They don't care, right?
And then they can't. They don't expect. I don't know. I don't think they expect to actually have a review.
But the point is, there was one game that got released last year. Nobody, not even IGN, not Game Informer, nobody got an advanced copy of this game. And day one, and this is like a game that I think required like about 60 to 70 hours of like your time in order to finish the game. Day one, there were people that released reviews. I was like, dude, you didn't even play through the game. You're releasing a review because you're trying to get clicks to your website. It's a disservice to the people who made the game. It's a disservice to game criticism, game journalism. Like, it's just game journalism itself is just a complete nightmare. It's such a hot mess.
Right now,
all it is a bunch of critics on Twitter insulting each other. Like, I just don't get it. It's not like this in the film world.
No, it's, you know why? Because they consider film, because there actually is an artistic element to film. I'm not saying that games aren't art, but they're the culture surrounding it has a far deeper artistic appreciation for filmmaking than the people who play video games have. They may say that games are art, but they don't appreciate them like art, that's for sure. And the people producing them don't think of them that way either. At least movie studios, as greedy as they are, they do these things called prestige pictures. They know they won't make money, but they know that it promotes film as art, and that's good for the film business. So they do them anyway, like Mother. Paramount making Mother, do you think they expected to make money on that movie? No, but that was an artistic achievement, and they just knew it would be a loss.
But you know, the thing is, it's like, I don't want to pat myself on the back, but when I try to write a review, like when I write a review of Salt and Sanctuary, which I'm going to publish like tonight, I try to like look at the game of what the developers are trying to do more than just like, say, for example, reviewing the controls. Like, why is the game called Salt and Sanctuary, for example? Let's start with that. Like, you know what I mean? Like, not just like, oh, the game is easy to control and you press R to do this and B to do this. Like, I find game reviews are so flipping boring to read most of the time. There's very few critics I found that are actually interesting to read and follow. people, because when you read the reviews, they actually like decipher the game. They write about the game and they go into more detail. It's not just about like, it's not like they have a checklist. Like, let's talk about the controls, let's talk about the graphics, and let's talk about the frame rate. You know what I mean? Like, that's boring.
Bad movie reviewers will do the same thing. They'll talk about the acting, they'll talk about the cinematography, they'll talk about the dialogue. You should only talk about things that stand out, and otherwise you should try to like convey what it's like watching the movie. The great film reviewers, they kind of just express their thoughts as they come to them. It reads more like you're having a conversation with that person. If you ever read Roger Ebert's reviews, they seemed very casual and yet incredibly deep, and you could tell the depth of film knowledge this person had. But not only that, but he was in touch with like the humanity of every film. He appreciated every film for what it was supposed to be.
What was really funny about him as a reviewer is that he would get really hung up on tiny, tiny details and then just ruminate on them for a very, very long time. And you would just be like, this is a movie review, right? And you're talking about like one singular moment in the movie, but he used those moments, the moments that stuck out to him, as an example of the rest of the movie. This moment was so subpar that the rest of the movie felt like it was just sort of floating on by, and that's it's an art form all its own.
But the point is that I just think that too many people are chasing clicks, which I find really, really annoying.
And the studios promote that by releasing games a certain way, by giving out their codes a certain way.
Right, but the thing is, it doesn't always have to be release all of the coverage for game review day one, because you know what? For example, say a game like Owlboy gets released. Not every single person is going to be able to buy that game the weekend it gets released. Maybe some people will purchase, I don't know, like Undertale because it gets released on the same day, for example, right? But then like you have to remind these people, hey, do you remember that game Owlboy? It's out there because there's like 500,000 million games on the Nintendo Switch, and maybe you can't see it because it gets pushed down on the eShop library, right? So it's not
that's where sales come in handy,
right? It's not a bad thing to still have reviews being published like a few days later, a week later, or just coverage in general.
I was going to say, well, here's the thing about that: it's so much different from the movie industry. But the video game industry tries so hard in some ways to copy the movie industry. But this is one particular case where they don't have to. These release dates don't mean anything for movies because they're never going to go away. Whereas a movie gets pushed out of theaters, and the studio really does need those reviews to drop on opening weekend, because that movie's probably only going to be around for 2 to 3 weeks, most movies. So they really need everybody to go see it right away. Opening weekend is huge, but games are there forever, like for so long.
For literal years, you can go to like whatever store you want and still pick up the same game regardless of how long it's been out. Yeah, that's totally true. I think the hardest part there is just that maybe the closest thing in terms of like media comparison, the closest thing to video games is probably movies. So we want to make these comparisons, but those two industries do not run parallel at all.
I would actually say TV, because like Patrick said, the movie gets pushed out of the cinemas like within like 4 to 6 weeks, right? Because you have the new movies coming out. TV, at the same time, you kind of want to have coverage before the TV show airs, because usually what happens is someone misses the first, second, or even third episode, they're completely lost. They can't follow the season. Like, not too many people jump in mid-season when watching a brand new show. They want to watch it from start to finish, right? So that isn't necessarily a problem with something like Netflix. But if you're watching, say, The Flash, and you've missed like the first like season, a lot of people won't want to start on season two. And so what happens is they start binge watching a DVD release, but then they just wait for season two to get released on DVD and so on and so forth. And when it comes to actual like weekly viewing, it needs to be something that they started from the very first episode. But video games, I mean, the Nintendo Switch, if anything, proves that it doesn't matter, because a game,
all the ports,
all of these indie games that are getting ported that were initially released 2 years ago, 3 years ago, a year ago, they are selling. Like, we're talking about like selling a million copies of a game that is 2 years old.
Skyrim sold, and it's like 7 years old. I don't know, 6 years old.
The mandatory mention of what's it called? Grand Theft Auto 5, which is still one of the
which continues to sell
games.
Every month. It's ranks on the charts, which is unbelievable. But it shows you that, well, certain games can have legs, but all a lot of games can have legs. I mean, when you look at, if people look at the top, you know, games in Japan or whatever, you know, Breath of the Wild is still ranking in the top 10. That came out a year and a half ago.
I just wanted to vent because, like, this has happened a few times where we actually get a game and we get it, like, day one. So, like, the game gets released and we get it, and now we have to stress and review the game. And it happened again this week. I'm not going to mention the company. I'm not going to mention the game. It's a big game. And they are going to send us the game the day it gets released. And I'm like, well, what's the point? I mean, like, you're contacting me 2 weeks earlier. You know, you just have to send me a digital code. It's not even like you have to go to the post office and physically mail me the physical copy of the game. I'm not asking for a physical copy. They are sending us a freaking digital code. Like, it takes 2 seconds by email. So why are you sending it the day it gets released? I might as well buy the game.
It particularly hurts as the little guy in the industry when you know that everyone can already go see any old review on any other source. Any other major publication has that review ready to launch. So,
and you're going to be last anyway. So why even write a standard review? But the thing is, this would all work fine. It wouldn't be a big deal to get a game late, because I understand that the companies want to ensure that they have the codes for the websites, the more popular websites. Fine. That's totally understandable. But if they're going to give us a code on day one or even later in some instances, just don't put a deadline on it.
Do not email us asking where the review is, because if you send us a review code for a game that requires 70 hours of my time, I'm going to take my sweet time playing that game and I'm going to enjoy it.
Absolutely, because that's the way you should, though, to review anything. It's not like I fast forward through a movie in order to and then write a review on it. You have to play the game the way it was meant to be played. What developers could do, this would be very interesting if they did do this, was fine, get it out to the big websites and get the reviews up. We're not important enough for them to get a review, so we don't get a code until later, but then ask us to do a feature instead. That way you continue coverage for your game, all the reviews will come up. We're not publishing something then that is basically like everything else that came out 2 weeks ago. Instead, we keep the conversation going by writing a feature about the game. And that gives them, you know, the coverage then has legs, and then maybe the game has legs. But instead, they just want to, like, why ask us for a standard review that's going to be late anyway? And when there's 70 critics reviews up on Metacritic already.
All of this just to say that it is really, really tricky and tough to be the little guy in the industry. Would you guys call us an indie site? Are we the indies, and sites like IGN are the triple A's?
Oh, for sure. I mean, we're not owned by a Fortune 500 company like IGN. I mean, the company that actually owns IGN is a $500 million company. Yeah. It's a Fortune 500 company, you know?
Even a company.
But you know, that really frustrates me, because I'm sorry, like, some of the more interesting websites that I browse are all indie, like, websites like Goomba Stomp. You know, I will visit Polygon and Waypoint. I honestly do not visit IGN. I do listen to their podcast, but I don't actually read their articles.
What articles? I think you mean read their slideshows.
Right.
And videos.
But you know, it's frustrating because, like, I'm sorry, like, you can't just rely on one publication like IGN. Like, imagine if a game was released and they only relied on one publication like IGN to review the game, and say for whatever reason the critic hated the game and gave it like a 6 or whatever, because they, for whatever reasons, like, the score matters to distributors and publishers. But then, like, you don't give the game to the whatever, like, 50 other, like, indie sites that would probably love the game. Like, at the end of the day, like, coverage is coverage. There's no such bad thing as exposure. Like, you know what I mean? Like, be it us or IGN or Polygon or, I don't know, Nintendo Wire or Nintendo Life or anybody, really, a podcaster, YouTuber, talking about a game, like, it's a good thing. Even if they say something bad. I was listening to a podcast. It's a Dark Souls podcast, and they were talking about Salt and Sanctuary. They hated the game. But I still listened to the podcast, and I appreciated their, like, criticism and their point of view. It was interesting to actually listen to. Anyhow, we got to move on.
We really have to move on. So, moral of the story, it sucks to be the little guy, but luckily, in the gaming industry, there are companies like Nintendo Take some time and put some effort forward to focus on the little guy, like in the Nindy Direct that we got just yesterday, August 28th. When we come back, we are going to review the Nindy Direct, talk about some of those games, talk about some indies that we've been playing, and introduce a very special guest. So don't go anywhere. Welcome back to NXpress. We're at our main event, which is a discussion of the Nindy Direct that just happened on August 28th, revealing some new titles coming to Switch. They themselves kind of called it the sister Direct to the one that we just got from Nintendo of Europe, highlighting even more indie games. So, needless to say, the Switch is still very much the home for indie games, maybe besides Steam, but at least, at the very, very least, it is like the console home for all indie games, including some games that we already have and some new ones. So I'm really excited to talk about some of these. But before we do that, I've got to introduce our guest who is finally here. Mike Warby is joining us once again. How's it going, Mike?
Surprise! Time zones. How you guys doing?
Doing pretty well. Rick's a little mad, but you're going to have to just listen to the episode for that because I'm not letting him talk about that one more second on the show.
Yeah, I caught the tail end of that rant. I was going to cut in to say we may not be owned by a Fortune 500 company, but we're owned by a Fortune 500 person. No. And that's you, Rick.
Thank God Mike didn't cut in.
Oh. Yeah, that would have been painful. Anyway.
Cut in to butter up the boss with a good old pun. Anyway, go on.
So, like I mentioned, we're going to talk about the Nindy Direct. Talking about some of these games which we have played before, some of these games which we haven't, that are totally new, and the ones we're looking forward to, and just overall impressions. Starting with the first one that was revealed, a game that I've played, that I loved. We reviewed it on Game Boys, because it is a co-op game, and now it's coming to the Switch, which means it's going to be 80% more fun. That's Hyper Light Drifter.
So we're also getting a special edition. So there's going to be added bonus material for this game. I think this game, if I'm not mistaken, cracked our top five of best games released in 2016. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was released 2 years
ago. I'm pretty sure you're right about that.
Yeah.
It made the top 10 for sure.
Yeah, definitely the top 10. So this is a game I am looking forward to actually reviewing on the Nintendo podcast. So I'm pretty excited about this game. This is on my top three of games I'm most excited for.
It's really, really cool. And like I said, I've played it and reviewed it for Game Boys. But as soon as they started talking about it, I was like, I don't remember that. And that's because there's a bunch of new stuff coming for the game, including a new weapon, a new outfit that gives you a different ability. So it's not just the standard edition. They're bringing a bunch of stuff that is exclusive to the Switch, at least for now, which is really, really cool. I'm glad to see that they actually touched it up and didn't just port it directly.
Yeah. You know what game I'm really excited for? It's Towerfall. So I don't know if anyone's played this game, but this is a game that's also made by the same guys that made Celeste. It's a Canadian studio, Canadian developers, Matt Makes Games. So this game, I haven't yet played it, but from my understanding, if you like the video game Celeste, you're going to love Towerfall. Apparently it's not as hard, though.
Well, it's a multiplayer battle game. That's what it is. And it was like the flagship game of Ouya. Remember that? When that was a thing?
I wish I could forget. I mean, what an unmarketable name.
I know.
People don't know what this is. They don't know how to pronounce it. It's like, who decided that this should be... anyway, Ouya.
Yeah. And people say the Wii U was the worst name console.
I don't even know if it is pronounced Ouya. I never heard anybody say it out loud before.
I thought it was Ouya, but it's not like I had anyone to debate it with.
Yeah, I remember when this game came out for that. This was pretty much the only game that came out for it, at least a original game that anybody thought was any good. I don't know. I mean, It's just a battle type game, as far as I'm concerned. I'm sure it's supposed to be a pretty good one, regardless.
The thing is, as I always say, like, I like these multiplayer games because when people come over, it gives me something new to play. I can't always whip out like Mario Tennis. Eventually, like, my friends and family are going to get like sick and tired of playing Mario Tennis. Of course, when Smash comes out, I mean, Smash is going to take care of that whole problem because that's all anyone's going to want to play. This new version has a 6-player battle mode, and also it introduces new characters, including Madeline and Battling from the video game Celeste. So
before we really move on, can we just talk about how I know that people complain when they give too much information about a game rather than just making it an exciting trailer, but every single one of these, anytime they're like, and you can play with your friends, I was like, can I play with my friends online? Because that is my constant struggle, where it's like, it used to be that my co-op partner Ryan and I would always just play couch co-op because he lived in the area and it was so easy for us. Now he lives in a different state and I'm like, can I play it online though? Can you just clarify that, like, play with 6 people online? Can you just say that one word so that I know? But no, can't.
2018.
Yeah, just gotta wait for the game to come out, I guess.
Sigh. But yeah, you guys will have to let me know whether Hyper Light Drifter is worth pushing through, because I bought it a couple months ago, played the first couple hours of it, couldn't really get into it, and I kind of just tuned out. So let me know if it's worth getting into. I didn't even realize it was a co-op game.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought you liked it. I thought you loved it. I must be confusing it with someone else.
No, Hyper Light Drifter is not a co-op game. Is it?
It is.
Really, Tim?
It is.
Yeah, it is.
I had no idea. Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, it looks like a single-player game, and I thought it was a single-player game when I was playing it, but I was already, you know, when, I don't know if you guys have ever had this experience, but when you first start playing a game, and you already feel like you're stuck within, like, the first couple hours, and it just turns you off of the game immediately, because it's like, I'm just running around in circles for, like, a half hour straight, and I have to either go online and start looking for what to do, or play something else, and I opted for the latter.
That's why I ditched Axiom Verge. And whatever, a lot of people love that game, but I was ultimately just bored with it. I was like, too much, the backtracking, I ended up getting stuck somewhere, and I don't remember where exactly, and I don't really care.
I
just abandoned that game, and I never thought of it again.
I'm glad you said Axiom Verge, because I immediately just thought the original Metroid, which is what Axiom Verge is trying to be.
Yeah.
Hmm. And I was like, it's like cool for what it did and what it brought us, but the first one is so rough that I never want to touch it ever again.
You know, the thing is that a game has to compel you to keep coming back for more, and
especially in this day and age.
Yes, and it did nothing to do that.
The original Metroid game, the only reason why people kept on playing the game was because back then you really had no choice. You had that game,
and
that
you had three games. You had three games in
that was your game for the year, probably, that you got for Christmas, and you wouldn't get it
until next year. And it was probably like $80. So you better play that game.
And like kids, I feel like are really good about obsessing over something and just like getting so into it, and you're talking with all your friends about it. So yeah, just not the right setting anymore. But there are a couple of these that I thought looked really, really cool.
Including Bullet Age, which is also a co-op game, Tim.
Yeah, a bunch of these are co-op or at least multiplayer. So I was definitely listening to a lot of these. One of the other ones that looked like it was at least multiplayer that I thought looked kind of cool, if a bit familiar, was the Treasure Stack. Looks like Tetris with a grappling hook, or the hook shot from Zelda.
Some of these games look interesting. Like, I honestly think Bullet Age looks like a lot of fun. It's a co-op game. I like the art style. Like, it looks like a very simple game that you can probably finish in like maybe less than 10 hours. We've already mentioned Hyper Light Drifter. But what I do not understand is they put a spotlight on Untitled Goose Game. So I'm assuming they do not even yet have a title for the game unless the game's actually going to be released.
That is the name.
That is the actual title? Okay, so
it's a joke. It's all very jokey. I thought that game looked amazing.
But it's weird. I'm not saying it doesn't look amazing, but it's just weird that they put a spotlight on that game, but they do not put a spotlight on The Messenger, Undertale, and Transistor, to name
because you just named three games that everyone already knows, and like they'll sell themselves.
I think they already highlighted The Messenger during one of their other directs anyway, so I think they've done that, and everybody knows The Messenger is coming out. Undertale has gotten so much press, do they really have to go into it too deeply? I mean, I don't think so.
I can vouch heavily for the quality of both Bastion and Transistor. Those are fantastic games. I've played through both of them. I bought them twice on different on different platforms and played through them twice and loved the crap out of them both times. Those are fantastic games.
I do not think that a lot of people are aware that these games exist or that they are even good. Like, not everyone has access to Steam. Not everyone plays games on Steam.
But a lot of these are on consoles already, or were on like the Wii U, or you know, like on pre-existing
consoles. Four people
bought. No, the thing is, a lot of these, like Bastion, was well publicized at the time. It was one of the very first Xbox Live games, wasn't it?
You're thinking of, yeah. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, didn't
you're thinking of Braid. Isn't
yeah,
it?
you're thinking of a different game, but yeah.
But no, Bastion was super well publicized, and it was a very popular indie game.
Okay, yeah, so out of all these games, what game has you the most excited, Patrick?
Oh, none of them. I found the whole presentation pretty underwhelming, actually. I don't think there's a single game on here that I really want to purchase.
Wait, you're telling me you have no interest in playing Undertale? Because I was planning on reviewing...
Oh, zero.
What?
No, I'm so like off of RPGs or anything long right now. Even if it's like 20 hours, it's going to give me pause for thought. After the 1-2 punch of Skyrim and Octopath, I'm like, short games... That's my new MO, and I started Hollow Knight, which might be have been a mistake. I'm sure that's like a 20-hour game,
that's like potentially upwards of 40. Yeah, it's pretty.
Oh, is it really?
Big. Right. Yeah.
Well, I'm liking it, so I'll probably be doing that one for a while. But no, I'm not really. Undertale never held any interest for me when it came out. I know it's supposed to be a great game, but there's something about meta usually turns me off, and Undertale obviously is that. So. When it came out and I read the reviews, I just thought, nope, not for me.
Wait, the guy from Minnesota and not the guy from Seattle is going to be a hipster about things?
Oh, God, Tim, you don't know much about Minneapolis, do you?
Minneapolis
flies
be
with
worse.
Portland for hipster
it
population.
It cannot be worse than Portland. Portland makes me want to punch, I don't know.
It has been
some idiot playing the spoons or something.
No, it's just not for me. I'm not like, well, I don't consider not, you know, meta is a hipster thing. I'm not really into meta. I'm a little more old-fashioned. I like sincerity in my storytelling.
Sign yourself up for a bit of that Bastion then, Patrick, because that's an 8 to 10-hour game, action RPG. You'll be in and out in one weekend, and you'll have a great time.
Is that only 8 to 10 hours? All right, well, that's at least a little bit better. And Hyper Light Drifter, you know, has me sort of casually interested in it. The Messenger, I kind of like the idea of The Messenger, but nothing really knocks my socks off with any of those indies. Nothing that I thought like, oh yeah, I gotta have this. There are a couple other ones that I'm waiting for that weren't mentioned in this direct, but like if we do one on the podcast, like yeah, sure, all right, I'll pick up The Messenger or Bastion. There's no way I'm gonna play through Undertale, like a role-playing game, but yeah.
When we started the podcast, I think when we started the website, one of the very first articles I wrote and one of the very first topics we discussed on the podcast is which indie games would we want to see released on a Nintendo console? This is back in the Wii U days, right? And every single one of those games is now available on the Nintendo Switch. So is there an indie game that you really, really, really want to play that is not yet available on the Nintendo Switch?
Got it. I'm ready.
So am I.
And the correct answer is Gang Beasts.
Okay.
Which is, it is literally a work of art. Just go watch a video. And
you guys
know
talked
that
about
it
on the Game Boys podcast.
We talk about it on Game Boys because it's at PAX every freaking year. And we still play it every year. But it has been in like early access for way too long. It finally came to PS4. And every year we're like, when's it coming to Nintendo? And when's it coming to Xbox? Mostly we mention Xbox. But now the Switch is perfect for it. So this year I'm going to harass them about the Switch. It is just a party game where you're these goofy mascot guys that are incredibly floppy and hard to control. And you just beat each other up and try to knock each other out and throw each other off ledges. It's so dumb, but it's magical. I don't know what it is. It is laugh out loud funny. And I think it really needs to be on the Switch.
All right, Patrick.
Now, I don't know if this is indie. Is Jonathan Blow, like, does he work exclusively with Microsoft? Because I want to play The Witness. I don't
that
really
is
care
an indie
so much
game.
About Braid.
The, wi- The Witness, I think he kind of made a deal with The Witness. The Braid was totally indie, though.
That was, yeah, I know that was before he had made a deal. Braid doesn't interest me as much, but The Witness I really want to play. That would be my favorite.
But I don't think it's exclusive to Microsoft, right?
No, like, PlayStation has it as well.
Oh, okay, then it's all right. Then
it's on Steam, it's on Xbox, on PlayStation. It could go on Nintendo Switch. It's totally an indie game. Right, from my understanding, it was developed by him and later published by... Who was it that published it? Anyhow, I can't remember. All right, that's actually a good pick, but I thought the game was coming to Nintendo Switch.
I have never heard it. I would be aware of an announcement. That's one I really, really would like to play, and I don't play games on PC, otherwise I would have done it already, but no, I'd like to see that one come to Switch.
Mike, what about you? I know you don't have a Switch yet, but...
No, but if I could insult you guys with any one game that I really want to see on the Switch, it would be Shower with Your Dad Simulator.
Oh my god!
awesome game. Could not stop laughing the whole time I was playing with that game. It's fantastic. It's just stupid little mini games with pixelated boys looking for their dads in the shower and other assorted bathroom mini games, which, I mean, just from the name alone, you think the game should be impossible, but it's pixelated so badly that you will not be offended. It's a lot of fun, and it's sort of like Tim was saying with Gang Beasts. It's just really stupid fun that you can't help but enjoy yourself while you're playing it.
I know. I think we all have those games that we just like can't help but love. I know, like, Surgeon Simulator is finally coming to the Switch, and my buddy Alex, also on Game Boys, is going to buy it yet again, and he never stops playing that game. And it's like, how many times can you beat one thing? But
you know what game I want on Switch? It's not an indie game, but it's Tetris, the original Tetris. I want Tetris on the Switch.
Yeah, I bet they'll come up with some kind of Tetris. They'll probably make it so that you can use the Switch, like turn the Switch on its side and get, you know, have more of the screen. They've already done, what did they do? They did a game like that already. One of those shooter games.
Yeah, they did Puyo Puyo Tetris already.
Yeah, but I want the original Tetris.
They did. Ikaruga, they did that one, I think, and that one you could turn it like to be more like an arcade game. Now, I will say this. All right, there was one game in there that I played at E3 a couple of years ago called Desert Child, and it looks a hell of a lot better than it was at that E3. Like, it's clearly gone through a ton of aesthetic changes, and it looks like there's just way more involved in that game. And I remember it being pretty fun, just in the simple version that I played.
See, I played it at PAX 2 years in a row, and this is one that I'm never, ever going to touch again.
Oh, yeah?
I did not like it. It's like a racing simulator sort of deal, like a 2D racer.
And a shooter at the same time, though.
Kind of, but not in like a fun way.
I don't know. I kind of liked it, and it certainly looks better. I would have to try it again. I did not try it at this year's E3, so I don't know. I'd have to take a look at it again.
So just to wrap up our news segment here, is there anything else we need to say about the indie games that they announced?
Not for me.
There is one more indie game that I really have to mention. It's a little game called Super Smash Bros. Ultimate. Oh, I'm totally kidding about it being an indie, but did you guys see that controller?
That's what I just wanted to talk about. Thank you for the transition, Tim. So yeah, they released the details for the special edition, which comes with a controller, which I really, really want. But you know what? Here's the thing. Even if you do not want to buy the special edition, you can still buy the controller on the side, which I think is great. Although the controller is worth more than the actual game. But at least you can use the controller for any game.
I like this better. Splatoon had a pro controller that I also got, and you didn't have the option to get it with the game at all. So I like that they're doing a bundle that comes with the controller and a special edition of the game that is literally no different. It just has a cool case.
So are you buying the special edition or just a controller? Because I want to buy the whole entire package.
I do want to buy the whole package. My issue is I didn't want to order it on Amazon when it was up for like 5 seconds. So I tried to go pre-order it at GameStop. But they're really, really bad about, like, something becomes available on their website, but you can't actually pre-order it in stores. So now I have to just, like, awkwardly, like, hope I see some sort of notification that you can now pre-order it and then go pre-order it so I can go pick it up in person.
Did you also notice the bundles? They now have like a bundle for games like Super Mario Odyssey, Zelda, and there's one more game, and it comes with like a collector's book.
It's like a guide.
Yeah, it's like a guide. Yeah. So yeah. It's like Nintendo wants me to spend more money. So I'm going to go buy Super Mario Odyssey again just to get the guide.
Oh my god.
Well, you know,
are,
you know the plan.
You are not going to,
the
are you?
The plan is I take Super Mario Odyssey to GameStop, I trade it in for cash, and then I buy the new Super Mario Odyssey and pay the extra, whatever it is, to get the new game plus the guide. I mean, do I want to do it? No. Am I going to do it? Maybe.
I think you've got a sickness, Ricky.
No, because you know why? Hear me out, okay? With Breath of the Wild, I wouldn't do it because I pretty much explored the whole entire map. I finished the game, including the DLC. With Super Mario Odyssey, I finished the game, but I've never actually found every single moon. So if there's like 900 moons, I maybe found 300. So that is a game I would actually go back and play again from start to finish and actually try to find all the moons. But
you don't even have to do it from start to finish again. You just can go back into each one of those worlds and pick up moons. I think I ended up getting a couple hundred afterwards. I only ended up with 550 or so of the 900.
Yeah, but I kind of want to play Odyssey again.
I only ended with 999 because I actually built up enough coins to just buy a bunch after.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I didn't even bother with that. I mean, Odyssey was fun for like the 25 hours I put into it, but I can't see. Every once in a while, I'll go back just to play a Mario game again really quickly, but I can't really see wanting to hunt for a lot of those moons. They just got kind of repetitive.
Also, Nintendo, look at me. That wasn't worth it. That killed my buzz by the end. It was the lamest. Oh, you did everything you absolutely can. Here's the lamest cutscene in the world.
Oh, yeah. The actual true ending. They didn't really give you a big reward for that. Nintendo doesn't really do bad, though.
Spoilers. Don't listen if you don't want to know. It's the castle has a hat on it. Peach's castle has a hat on it at the end.
Literally, isn't that just adorable?
He was like, I expected my decision. I expected like nothing that special, but I would have gone for just about anything other than that.
Okay, wait a second, though. To contrast that with Breath of the Wild, I did get all the Korok seeds, and they do give you a giant piece of poop as a reward. Now, is that better or worse? I actually was fine with that. I was like, yeah, that's about right. But I had a good time collecting those things.
That's super funny. I did not know that.
Yeah, you just get a piece of poop. They don't actually call it that, but they give you a little swirling pile.
Yeah.
And they say, ooh, it kind of stinks.
So funny.
A few days ago, I was on Facebook and I was just like telling everyone how I wanted to get back into reading comic books because I really miss it a lot. And one of the problems with reading comic books is it's actually a really expensive hobby. So I was thinking, I'm just going to go and buy some comics at the actual store, like the actual physical books, like maybe from Image Comics, and then everything else, I'm just most likely just going to go digital, right? And then sure enough, 2 days later, Nintendo announces this crazy app for Nintendo Switch in which you can read all of your comic books on the Switch. It's like the Switch is going to be like the ultimate entertainment system for me. The only thing that's missing is Netflix.
Unbelievable. I'm sure.
We've got a skeptic in Mike Warby here.
What on earth is... I forgot that even happened. It's just like every once in a while... Like, Nintendo's made a lot of progress with this generation, don't get me wrong. But every once in a while, something like that comes up and you're just like, what is reality?
No, but this is actually a really good deal, Mike, because it's $8 a month, right? If you go and you buy a comic book
costs
you about $5.
He's talking about
Netflix. The Netflix.
That's
all
I was talking about. I'm not shitting on your comic service. I'm sure the comic service is fine.
My immediate response to Netflix was like frustration. Like, why would you not just put this on there? Not even that I would use it ever, but like just I want to have it there just because what if I want it? But do you guys think that someone like, maybe Netflix was being too greedy and Nintendo just like shrugged and said, we'll go without for now. And is like waiting it out or something.
No, I think they're just waiting. Like we haven't yet even had a direct or any concrete information about the Nintendo service online. Like they've released some information. Like we know we're going to get 30 games. They've only announced 10 of 30. We know how much it's going to cost, but there's a lot that we do not yet know about the online service. I'm 100% sure we're going to get Netflix. Guys, we had Netflix.
Oh, yeah,
on the
for
Wii.
Sure.
Like, the Wii had Netflix. I still have a friend who has a Wii. Not a Wii U, not a Switch, a Wii. And she watches Netflix on her Wii. So, I'm 100% sure we're going to get Netflix on Switch. It makes no sense not to.
No, I don't doubt that it'll come eventually. I'm just wondering why they waited. It's curious.
Anyway. Unpopular opinion, my favorite place to watch Netflix for a long time was my Wii U.
Really?
I actually watched all of my streaming services through the Wii U. Mm-hmm. Because it was faster, easier, and like less dumb than my Xbox. Like, so many things about the Xbox apps just bugged the hell out of me. I was like, you know what? My Wii U is both faster and easier for whatever reason. Part of it was the touchscreen was like super nice to just like punch stuff
definitely
in.
Definitely.
I miss
wow,
it.
Wow, so I never played it on my Wii U. I only played on my Xbox.
No, it
was awesome because you could just, you don't have to scroll through like you do with most, like generally you just have a normal controller, so you're scrolling around the screen through all the options. You could streamline that with the Wii U's tablet and just tap what you wanted to do, and it was just neat, and it was cool, and it was fast, and it was intuitive. It was very, very cool. Very cool.
Every once in a while, that scenario of like, I want to watch something, but like my wife wants the TV, I would actually just like watch on my Wii U gamepad every once in a while. It actually worked just fine.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was cool. Mike's right. It was super awesome. So the Switch could be equally as awesome and just as ripe for viewership, but I don't know. I really don't know why they're waiting. Anyway, comics are cool. So we are going to take a break. No transition for you. We're just going to end this. We're going to be right back. When we come back, we're talking Salt and Sanctuary, so don't go anywhere. Welcome back to N-Express. We're at our final segment, the segment that I am titling Ricky's Favorite Game of the Week, which is this week, Salt and Sanctuary. Quick note, though, Patrick did have to step out, so he wanted me to say his farewells. He wanted to go to Goomba Stomp, check out all his work on the site, in particular on our film section, where he does a ton of work. He would really appreciate that. He also said that he's been in denial and that he had a huge change of heart, and Majora's Mask is his favorite game now. So why don't we go ahead and roll into Salt and Sanctuary, which is the Dark Souls of indie video games right now. And I hate that everyone always compares everything to Dark Souls, but Mike, you have a Dark Souls podcast. Does that comparison stand with this game?
Hell yes. Hell yes. I mean, like, this game came to me at a very great point in my life. In early 2016, I got canned from my job that I've been doing for 2 years. That I'd sunk a lot of my time into, and it was a bad experience, and this game kind of came out right at that time, and I had like a month where I wasn't working, where I was kind of like looking for a job and stuff, and this game was just there for me every day to just sink hours and hours and hours of time into. I love it to death. Great game.
Wow. I just quit my job, and I started playing Salt and Sanctuary. And I've actually never played Dark Souls. I've only played Bloodborne. And I was just sold, like, right away within an hour playing this game. I love this game. I talked about it last week briefly. I raved about how it's one of my favorite games on the Nintendo Switch right now. It does wear its inspirations on its sleeve. You mentioned Dark Souls. It borrows, I guess, the lore, the character progression, and the class system, and I guess even the checkpoint method of Dark Souls, right?
It is almost literally just 2D Dark Souls, which I'm totally fine with, but go
on. Right, but at the same time, though, Mike, I could not help but escape the comparison to early Castlevania games. Mm-hmm. Like the world progression, the level design, the non-linear landscapes. It is sort of like a Metroidvania game. The thing about Salt and Sanctuary is I honest to God think, and I'm actually writing a review of the game tonight, I think it's one of the most underrated video games I've ever played, because I have not yet heard anyone rave about this game, at least not critics. Like, I know a lot of my friends love this game, but like when I go on like Metacritic or browse reviews, I've seen people like give the game like a 6 on 10. I was just like, are you guys crazy? This game is made by two people, Tim. It's a husband and a wife, Ska Studios, out of Seattle, by the way, Seattle. So, and paying homage to two of the most beloved video game franchises of all time is not an easy task. And yet, again, the two-person team at Ska Studios made what I think is one of the best indie games, and also, Tim, I think the best co-op game available on the Nintendo Switch, and that's one of the reasons why I fell in love with the game. Because, Mike, we were talking about this. On the Nintendo Switch, I think it's different on PlayStation 4. On the Nintendo Switch, you can actually play couch co-op. So my nephew came over, and basically he started playing the game with me. So instead of having one player, we now had two players, which also technically in ways makes the game easier. So, for example, if you're battling a boss, it's way easier when you have two people versus one. But outside of like the boss battles, it kind of makes the game harder because you have to rely on your friend to keep up. So if you're like, say, jumping from one platform to the next platform and your friend doesn't keep up, someone's going to die.
Well, there's some actually, yeah, really tricky platforming sections in that game. But to go back to what you were saying about the inspirations, like we were doing our top 10 games by writer for a while here on Goombastomp. We did like probably 15 or 20 of them. And my list had Dark Souls and Castlevania Symphony of the Night both in that top 10. And that's why I love this game so much. And I agree with you that it's highly, highly underrated, because I couldn't stop playing this game to save my life at that time. When you don't have a job, you're just like, what do I do with myself every day, right? You fall out of your routine. You're kind of depressed because you're like, you know, you feel like you're not doing anything useful. So video games become a huge refuge in that time, especially a game you can just sink yourself into like this one. But yeah, fantastic game, man. I love this game.
How many hours did you put in? Because I put in 65.
See, this is an interesting thing. I've played through the game a few times over, but my count of hours is like at like 560. I don't think I played the game for 560 hours, though. I think it has, like, sometimes some games will keep counting your hours if you put the game in sleep mode.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And I think that's what happened, because there's no way I played the game that long.
So here's the thing. It brings up two very valid points, or two points I have to bring up. Okay, number one, Salt and Sanctuary is a game for two types of players. It's for the player who loves to take his time, explore the area, every nook and cranny, and just try to make sense of the lore, the characters, like actually try to figure out what the story is about, who these people are, talk to the NPCs in the actual game. But it's also a game for the player who just wants to hack and slash his or her way to the very end of the game. Either way, it works. But what's great about it, like you said, Mike, you can replay this game, because when you start the game, you have to first pick your character, your class. So you can start as a ranger, a hunter, a cleric. You can even play as a chef. And it's funny, when you choose a chef, the only item you're given is an actual pot, which is hilarious. But it changes the whole playthrough of the game, depending on what character you use, because each character has a specific weapon and a specific ability that the other characters might not have or might not like. Or you could actually eventually get some of the weapons and abilities, but just every time you pick a character, they each have an advantage and a disadvantage, right?
Well, yeah, the big thing, though, is that you've got the New Game Plus system, which, like in Dark Souls, the environments sometimes change, the enemies get harder, they give you more experience, so that gives you another incentive that makes it worth replaying as well.
The thing about this game, too, and this is what I sort of like hinted at last week when I was comparing it to like Zelda, is that, first of all, there's so many weapons to choose from, and you can upgrade each and every single weapon, but... like in Zelda, your weapons break. Now in this game, your weapons don't necessarily break, but you have to decide what weapon you want to upgrade. Do you want to, what's the terminology? It's transmute one weapon to become a different kind of weapon. You can also sell weapons. I made the mistake of selling one of the great swords. It's the only great sword you can actually find in the game. I was not aware it was a great sword. In order to get any of the other 9 great swords in the game, you need that sword. You need to upgrade that sword. So I never actually played with a great sword because I just did not know. I sold my great sword and never had a chance to actually upgrade to get any one of the other 9 swords. And apparently the best weapon in the game is one of the great swords. But there's different weapons you can use. There's different creeds. And we got to talk about the creeds. There's different kind of characters. And the game allows you, the player, to make choices. And when you make a choice, here's the thing. When you decide something, when you do anything in this game, there's no turning back. If you sell a weapon, that's it. It's done. It's over. If you make a choice, it's over. Like, if there's no turning back. It's not like you can have, like, multiple save points. You know what I mean? There's one save, and that is it. As soon as I was finished the game, after 65 hours of playing this game, I want to start all over again, play as a different character, and just, like, explore the whole entire area from start to finish, and hopefully... discover some secrets that I did not know exist, because there's so many secrets everywhere to be found.
Which is like all really, really good news. I'm super glad to hear all this, because this is a game that like deeply interested me, but it was only available on the PS4, which I didn't own yet. So when it came time for like picking games for my co-op podcast, this is one that we really wanted to play but never could because it's still not on Xbox One. But Ryan and I both have Switches, so it's really, really exciting to have this deep, immersive game that we can now hop into.
You can't play the game online co-op mode, not with the Switch. It has to be couch co-op. You have to be in the same room.
Is that true of the PS4 as well? Do you know?
I could check for you, but I'm not sure. I rarely play with people in my house, so I never really checked for that feature in games. It was like news to me when Rick even said that was a feature of the game. I was like, I don't think that's in the PS4, but it could be. I really don't know.
The way it works is when you are at a sanctuary, there's different characters that you can sort of like call to populate your sanctuary. Like basically they will take refuge at the sanctuary, and there's one specific character, and if you go talk to him, he asks if you need help. And mm-hmm. So if you say yes, you can hire the character. And when you press A and you hire the character, it asks you to it asks for player 2 to basically choose the controller. So it's asking for player 2 who is in the room to choose which controller he or she is going to use. So basically you have to be in the same room. You can't play online. But Tim, just one more thing I got to say. Well, there's so many things I have to say. But going back to the comparison of Zelda... and by the way, I love Breath of the Wild, don't get me wrong. But in this game, especially for what is essentially an indie game, once again developed by 2 people, this game is so massive. And it feels even bigger than it actually is. But what I find so mind-blowing about this game is each stage looks different. Each stage has unique enemies, unique boss battles, a visual aesthetic that looks completely different than the previous level. The atmosphere changes. I mean, you go from like a poisonous swamp to like a jungle to an underground temple to like a cemetery to this like dungeon that's populated by like all kinds of like weird creatures, like walking dead skeletons, to witches, to these Raggedy Ann demonic dolls. I love the art style and just the design of each and every single one of the creatures, especially the bosses. And the boss mm-hmm. battles are fantastic. There is, I think, if I'm not mistaken, there is 23 bosses to fight, 3 of which are optional. There's 5 side quests, and there are 22 areas in total. This is an indie game. So you can actually finish this game in about 30 hours if you rush through it. But if you really want to take your time and explore it and find all of the hidden secrets, you could put in easily 60 to 65 hours, as I did.
Well, and that's why I want to recommend this game to Tim. And I think he will enjoy it because I know that he played through Dark Souls 3. And I know that he's a huge fan of Symphony of the Night. So I think you could pick this up pretty quick based on your experience. And I know, yeah, since you like love Symphony of the Night, when people ask me what this game is, I always say Dark Souls meets Symphony of the Night. And if that sounds like something you're interested in, then I just say go get it right now because it is an awesome game.
Can I ask you guys a question about Dark Souls? In Dark Souls, like, I know you have the bonfire. And from my understanding, the bonfire is where you go to sort of like, I guess, heal yourself?
Yeah, imagine basically Dark Souls, if we're using the naming strategy of Salt and Sanctuary, Dark Souls would be called Souls and Bonfire. And that's basically, you level up with the souls, bonfire is your safe space.
Okay, because in this game, you have a sanctuary. And in the sanctuary, you have a creed. And so you choose your creed, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like your religion.
Right.
But the thing I love about this game, and I don't know if it's like this in Dark Souls, is so like there's a religious angle to this game, right? And I think that's what sets it apart from most games I've played like it. So, for example, you have your character and you choose your creed. But there are different creeds in the game. There's three to be exact. Actually, there's more than three, but whatever. There's three that start.
Wait, there's Assassins, there's Templars. What's the other one?
I see what he's doing.
He got he's there. He got there.
Making an Assassin's Creed joke, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. no, there are seven creeds in Salt and Sanctuary. There's seven.
I thought there was nine. But anyway, yeah, whatever.
I think, there's nine with the two hidden.
Yes, creeds. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Right. So the thing is, there's seven, technically nine in total. But depending on which creed you choose, you will get a different ending. But what I love about this game, and this is my favorite moment, I actually wrote about this in the review, which I'm going to publish later tonight on the website. What I love about it, like my favorite moment in the game, is there's at one point you come across this lady, this mysterious lady, and you want to get past her and unlock a door, but you can't. And the only way you can unlock the door is you have to give up your allegiance to whatever creed you currently follow. But the thing is, as soon as you do this, the people in your creed will then attack you and murder you. So you actually have to technically commit suicide, or I guess let these people murder you. And you get washed up on shore, and you get an item, and you bring that item back to the mysterious lady, and then you can walk through the door, which leads you to what's called the Blackest Vault. And when you're in the Blackest Vault, then you can become part of a creed called the Order of the Betrayer. I don't know if you got there, Mike.
Yeah, I platinumed this game, so you can bet that I saw pretty much everything in it.
So this is like technically the evil creed, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But in order to get specific items and magic spells in the game, which you don't technically need to finish the game, but it's really cool if you get them, you actually have to turn against your own creed, destroy the temple, have these people turn on you, murder you, then come back to life, wash up on shore, and then take an oath to the evil creed. I just love the way it plays around with religion. I love everything about it thematically. Like, even the fact that it's called Salt. Like, and I wrote about this at the beginning of my article. Like, people take salt for granted. Like, I know I do. Like, salt to me is just something I put on my food, right? But it's played like a major role in mankind's survival. Like, the fact that salt was once regarded as the most important thing when it came to trade between various civilizations. The Egyptians in Egypt used to use salt to trade for gold. Even thematically, like, if you think about it, it purifies, it wards off evil, it heals. The way they thematically even use salt in the game, like, it's not like in the game, it's currency, right? So, and it's like this in Dark Souls. In Bloodborne, it's actually salt, right? So
it's up, blood echoes or blood something anyway. Yeah, go on.
Which is a stand-in for salt. But you pick up the salt, and then with the salt, you can level up. You can level up your character, your weapons, etc., etc. And I just love the way they thematically link salt to the entire game, and especially the way it links to religion, because of how religion, like specific various religions, see salt like in different ways. Like there's a meaning behind like
a metaphor.
Exactly. Well, salt will represent loyalty or purification, which makes sense because you put salt on like a wound or like your food or protection. But the thing about salt is that it can actually also kill. And so that duality is what makes it cool and what that's why thematically, the way it links to the game, I think is kind of ingenious. And I was wondering if Dark Souls was like that.
It has an aspect of that. They're called covenants in Dark Souls. But I don't think the covenants are as important to the overall lore of Dark Souls as they are to... Like, there's certain covenants that are more important, and there are ones that are kind of just there. I like the element of the creeds in Salt and Sanctuary because it feels like you're actually signing up to, like, a religious belief. And I like how well-developed they are, too, because it almost feels like they have, like, a Game of Thrones-type quality to them, where it reminds me of, like, you know, when you watch Game of Thrones or read it or whatever, and there's, like, the people who believe in the old gods, and there's the people who believe in the new gods. And Salt and Sanctuary has a similar system where it's, like, if you believe in this type of thing, this is what you should think. Like, there's even one for atheists. I can't remember what it's called, but there's one for people who just believe in the earth, and there's a creed for that. And there's, like, people who respect nature, and there's a creed for that. And it's, like, all these different sort of just ways of looking at the world, and they inform the way your character interacts. They change what healing item they get. There's all these, like, fringe effects as well that change depending.
The developers have actually said that they were first influenced by Game of Thrones, specifically House of Greyjoy.
That makes
then
sense.
Then later, when they decided to go out and make the game, they decided that they wanted to make something similar to Dark Souls, only it would be a 2D platformer. And then eventually they started taking inspiration from games like Ninja Gaiden or Castlevania, specifically Symphony of the Night. So there's a lot of inspirations here, but they also took inspiration from the previous games too. I just love this game. I absolutely love this game. I'm telling you, it is hands down one of the five best games on Nintendo Switch. It is one of my favorite games I've played in the past, like, year or two. And there's so much to talk about. Even, like, the boss battles, like, Tim, it's hard. Like the thing about the bosses is that every boss, like, some bosses are incredibly tough. Like, I don't know about you, Mike, but I had, like, some massive trouble with one specific boss, the Witch of the Lake. Oh my god, it took me like 10 hours to beat her. Some bosses were super easy, but the thing I love about the bosses, it's once again, it's going back to the art style. It's like you look at the Queen of Smiles, or the first boss, the Sodden Knight, or there's this boss which is a giant tree, and there's like these dead corpses hanging from like the tree. It's called the Tree of Men, you know. It's just like there's a lot of it's just like the amount of imagination, creativity that went into just designing each and every single one of these characters. I have to compare it to Zelda because I'm trying to decide what my favorite game is on Nintendo Switch. And you know, when you play Breath of the Wild, as amazing as it is, you don't get this variety. You don't get these many bosses that are so incredibly different from the previous. Like, you go from one boss to the next boss, and it's completely different than the previous boss you battled. Like, in terms of how you have to beat them. And the thing about this game, you can level up to, I think it's like 599, right? Like, you start at level 1. There's this big tree. A tree? What do you call it?
It's like a skill tree. It's like a skill tree. Yeah, it's if people massive. Played Final Fantasy X, you'll be familiar with it. It's similar to, like, the sphere grid from Final Fantasy X.
Exactly. So you can be at, like, say, even, like, level 150, and it does not mean that it's going to make it easy for you to beat a specific boss, because you have to factor in what kind of a weapon you're using, what kind of armor you're using, what kind of magic do you have, and there's also rings that you can collect, and each ring will give you a specific ability, like a special power. So a ring can, for example, decrease the amount of damage that you take from fire or from magic, or would increase your health, etc., etc. And so, like, there was one boss that I just could not beat. And I was just like, why the hell can I not beat the boss? And then I realized that all I have to do is put on some armor and a shield that can deflect his lightning bolts and use a specific ring or two. And then that would increase my defense. And therefore, I can now beat him without dying in, like, one hit. And so it's interesting. Like, you really have to pay attention to what you collect, the weapons, how you upgrade your weapons. And again, it's about choices. And sometimes you're going to make choices and you're going to regret it. And that's what I think makes the game so, so incredibly amazing.
Well, that makes me wonder what you're going to think about Dark Souls when it comes out. I would like to hear your opinion when you get around to Dark Souls, because Dark Souls has that aspect in spades. There's a boss in Dark Souls called the Four Kings that killed me for hours and hours and hours. when I was first playing that game. And then finally I got the revelation of just two-handing my sword instead of trying to use a shield. And you walk in and you just beat the shit out of the boss before he gets a chance to summon the other sort of helper characters that he gets. And you win. But the entire game teaches you to play defensively, so you don't think of that. And that's sort of the same thing Salt and Sanctuary picks up on, where it's like, you every once in a while, you have to change your strategy in order to adapt to what the game is throwing at you. And it's because it wants you to try things out. It's like when you compare it to Zelda, that's where they're similar, where Breath of the Wild wanted you to try different weapons. So it keeps encouraging you to change your loadout, change what you're doing. Don't just do the same thing for the whole game, because it's more fun for you and you're getting more out of the game that way.
Right, but if you compare Zelda to Salt and Sanctuary, Salt and Sanctuary has over 600 weapons, armor, pieces, spells, items, over 600. And the thing is, you won't just like find a weapon. You have to actually understand how to upgrade your weapons. You have to go to the sanctuary and call a blacksmith and get salt. Like a lot of people compare it to Dark Souls, and when people say that, they think, oh, the game's like extremely hard. Okay, the game can be tough at times, but it's not hard. Like the way to describe the game is it's complex. There's a lot to learn. And so when I loaded up the game, I would say for like the first hour or two, I had no idea what I was doing. Like I had no idea what the creed was. I did not understand that you could upgrade your weapons. I did not even understand the whole thing about salt. Like I was like, okay, I'm getting salt. I was more concerned about the actual gold. And then I realized salt is actually more valuable than gold. You know what I mean? And so the thing about this game is I think it would be incredible if they can actually release a physical copy with an instruction manual to actually explain to players how the game works. Even like you mentioned the tree of skill. I mean, I had no idea what I was doing at first. I was like staring at this giant glowing tree and I'm like, okay, I don't know. I'm just going to pick this, and this, that. And then afterwards I realized, okay, no, I got to like actually be smart about this. You know what I mean?
To bounce off what you're saying, Rick, that kind of ties into the Dark Souls design philosophy, which I mentioned that I wanted to kind of get into on here. And the idea behind Dark Souls when it was first being developed is that the creator of the series, Hidetaka Miyazaki, wanted to go back to this sort of foundation of... Because he, like a lot of us, grew up playing NES games. And he remembered going to school and talking to his friends because there was no internet. And a lot of the time you couldn't afford the guides. So how you figured out how to play a game was by talking to your friends who also played the game. And that's where the design philosophy for Dark Souls came from. And I think that's what Salt and Sanctuary was doing as well. And that's why it would be, like, I get what you're saying with an instruction manual, but that would be sort of against the point of the game. Because the whole point of a game like that is to pick it up, play around with it, and just figure it out. And kind of just get those aha moments that come for you that most games just hand to you within the first 20 minutes, you know?
Right, and you know, I will say, I messaged you about 45 hours into the game, and I was like, Mike, I'm stuck. I need to actually ask you a question or turn to the internet, and I didn't want to turn to the internet because then I would be like flicking through a whole YouTube video and get spoiled on a bunch of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But what I did not know, and I did not know that you can create this, like, the super jump, and by creating the super jump, you have to press two buttons at the exact same time. But the game does not even tell you what controls to press for specific movements. So I had no idea that you can actually do the super jump. Now, that said, it's amazing when you discover you have an ability by mistake. Like when I discovered that if I light up a torch, I can all of a sudden like pass through the level because these little blue lights would like a little blue invisible platform would appear and would allow me to be able to cross whatever level it is and get to the next stage, right? That's great. Like that's accidental. But I got to say, like, I can see a lot of people getting frustrated. So to close off my review here of Salt and Sanctuary, I think this is an incredible game. If you have any interest in Dark Souls, which is coming out on Nintendo Switch very soon, I recommend playing this first. But I would say just go to the wiki page and just read just a little bit, just at the start. Like, do not ruin anything for you. Don't spoil yourself. Just maybe a little quick sort of like a starter guide, just to give you an understanding of how the game works, and then dive in.
For sure, yeah. It's a fantastic game, and I love it to death, and I'm happy to talk about it anytime anyone will give me an excuse.
So if you miss the sensibilities of some older games that have absolutely no hand-holding, or you just want to enjoy the endeavors of two individuals who somehow managed to create something about as complex as something like Dark Souls that took an enormous team, check out Salt and Sanctuary, which is on the Switch right now. And while it doesn't have online co-op, I checked, it does have couch co-op, so enjoy it with a friend and loved one. I think that is it for the show. Thank you for joining us this week, Mike.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Where can we find you online?
Well, you can find me on GoombaStomp, of course. Even if you don't see articles from me, you will see me, or I guess you'll feel me in the back end of the site with my puppet strings. But I have two other podcasts on the site that I do. One with your Game Boys co-host, Ryan Kapioski, The Fire Keepers, which Ricky mentioned, the Dark Souls podcast. And the other one is, Ricky, we actually did our eighth episode of The Fire Keepers is on Salt and Sanctuary. So worth a listen now that you've played that game. But I also do a show called Warp Pipe, which Patrick was on a few weeks ago doing Super Mario World Retrospective. And, of course, I'm also on Twitter at Gameskeeper Mike.
Amazing. And what about you, Rick?
You won't find me online for the next, 10 days because I'm going to go to Cuba and I won't have access to the internet on purpose. But in about 2 weeks, I will be back online. You can find me at GoombaStomp.com. My Twitter handle is GoombaStomp. Like us on Facebook. And remember, you can listen to our show on various platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher. You know, for a full list, go to the website, GoombaStomp.com, and check any post of NXpress. And leave us a review on iTunes or anywhere if you like our show.
I am Tim Mason. You can find me at The Freemason, M-A-I-S-O-N, on Twitter. This weekend, you can find me at PAX West in Seattle. I'll be there if you think you see me. Yell Tim or something obscene and I'll look and we can chat. Love to hear from you. Feel free to tweet at me or the NXpress handle on Twitter and we can talk about what you're playing. I'll also come back with a full report of all of the sweet indies that I'm sure I'll get to play. Not to mention some big games from Nintendo like Mario Party, which is rumored to be there. So look forward to that. Thanks again for listening. I'll talk to you more next week with all things to Nintendo. See you later.